It is well decided, and we agree, that students do not shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse door. However, it is equally well decided that those constitutional rights will be administered in a way that is sensitive to the school environment.
Hello and welcome back to the High School SCOTUS podcast. I'm Elise Spenner.
And I'm Hannah Saroff.
Today we take a break from our affirmative action coverage, which do not worry, there will be more of, no matter how dismal it might be, to talk about maybe an even more dismal ruling in 303 Creative versus Colorado. It's a case where the court found that creating a website for a wedding was a form of creative expression, and that a person could claim that a law that required them to create that website for an LGBTQ couple violated their free speech rights. So we thought it would be really valuable to talk about that case and at the same time to discuss a subject that is long overdue to be broadcast on this podcast, the rise in anti-LGBTQ sentiment around the country and in state legislatures, expressing itself in the form of bills that restrict discussion of gender identity and sexual orientation in schools, and especially bills that ban gender-affirming healthcare for trans youth. So we have a really valuable and really substantive conversation that breaks all of that down for you.
So today we talked to an amazing expert senior attorney from the ACLU, Joshua Block. He is an incredible staff attorney at the ACLU, and he's in the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and HIV projects. He is the lead counsel in really important cases recognizing Title IX and the right to use the bathroom that aligns with someone's gender identity, and was also a member of the legal team that litigated Obergefell and Windsor before the Supreme Court. And he has litigated cases seeking marriage for same-sex couples all over the country. He does a ton of different work, and it's all focused around LGBTQ plus rights. So we thought he would be the perfect person to talk to today, and we just loved our conversation with him, and we think you're gonna really enjoy it too.
Josh is just doing incredible work. He is doing really, really hard work, but he is doing great work, and we're just so lucky that we had someone as knowledgeable as him on the podcast. This is a hard conversation. We'll acknowledge that up front. It's not a conversation that is super hopeful or uplifting, but it's a conversation that we think is really important that we had on the podcast, and we're so grateful that he came on to speak with us. Josh, thank you so much for joining us today. We're so lucky to have you.
Thanks so much for having me here.
I get to ask the first question because it's my favorite, but it's about you when you were younger. So what were you like in high school?
In high school, wow. I was on the student newspaper. I loved English class and history, the poli-sci part of it. I was a big nerd, and I probably thought I wanted to go to law school or be an English professor, something that involved being alone and writing a lot, I think.
Tell us about what your work now looks like. I know it's not just writing alone a lot, and what you do on a day-to-day basis and how that's changed a little bit in recent years, maybe.
Well, what I do on a day-to-day basis in terms of just the physical work I do probably hasn't changed too much. There's being a lawyer, especially a lawyer that does sort of impact litigation that involves a lot of questions of law, you know, is a lot more solitary than being a trial attorney. So I do have a lot of office time and writing time, but also on the phone a ton, on Zoom a ton now. But the really fun part is being able to travel and see clients in person and to go to court and do arguments. Going to depositions is a little bit less fun. That's sort of being in like a big conference room for an endless amount of time. And I guess the least fun part of my job is sort of just internal meetings. I think as for a lot of jobs, just meetings happen a lot. And if I could have a job without meetings and just doing the work, that would be my dream. But I'm not sure that exists in this universe.
Kind of more specifically, what does your job look like when you have to respond to emergencies or laws that are passed unexpectedly and there's immediately litigation that needs to be filed? Do you do that?
Yeah, of course. So I like to say my job description has gone from moving the law forward to slowing the law down. And so I think when I first started working here, I did a lot of work on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and on a lot of employment discrimination cases, obviously, and a lot of marriage litigation. And we were in a period where I think a lot of progress was being made on those issues. And of course, since 2016, the nature of that job changed dramatically. I think during the Trump administration, everyone over here, both in my project and other projects, had to file a lot of emergency cases to respond to whatever executive order or tweet came out that day. And that's what happened for the attempt to ban transgender people from the military. That was literally announced on a tweet. And I was reading the tweet on, you know, the escalator up from the subway, walking to the office, and had to then get into my office and start launching a case. Now we have just an incredible onslaught of attacks on trans youth in particular, and these bans on gender affirming care, where 2 years ago, one state passed one and it was a huge outlier. And then a second state passed one the next year and it was a huge outlier. And we're going to be likely in a position within a couple months to have 21 states have passed these laws. And they just have such an immediate devastating impact on kids and their entire families that we have different teams in trying to set up cases in states across the country. And I know that other organizations are doing the same. And even then, even with every single organization doing it, we're still not able to sue everywhere. It's a crisis.
Speaking of this crisis in terms of the rise of laws against trans youth, now so much of your work relates to the rights of students and children and their ability to learn about sexual orientation and gender identity in schools and the right to read books and honestly just their right to gender-affirming healthcare. Why do you think children are under attack?
No, that's really a great question, actually. And I think some of it is this rhetoric about parental rights being distorted and weaponized, where we know in practice that actually doesn't mean parental rights for everyone. It means some people getting to decide not only what their own children read or exposed to or receive medical treatment for, but they want to set the rules for everyone's kids as well. I also think there's traditionally a lot of hysteria about LGBTQ folks has been pushed under the prospect of protecting kids. That was Anita Bryant's huge crusade. And so I think using children as the terrain for trying to attack LGBTQ people is a well-established technique. I think there's some sort of anxiety and fear mongering among people that something's going to be done to turn their kids gay or trans, and that, you know, somehow every other kid who is gay or trans has somehow been, that's a result of adults doing things to them, of transitioning them. And so I think some of it's from that anxiety, but it's really obviously heartbreaking to see what these kids are being put through. It's hard enough to be a teenager or preteen or younger. And to have this on top of all of that is just really an unimaginable level of stress we put on folks who already are under a lot of stress, if for no other reason that they're teenagers.
Yeah, I think it's incredibly frustrating to see just people using teenagers to win political points or to look like they're doing something that satisfies a conservative base. But to talk specifically about gender-affirming medical care, because that's a lot of, I assume, what your work is about right now, even Trump judges have ruled against these bans. What does this say about how radical the political landscape has become in these conservative state legislatures and even just the dialogue around what we accept as legitimate?
So things have deteriorated in the past 2 years to an incredible degree. So when the first ban passed in Arkansas 2 years ago, it was vetoed by Governor Hutchinson as a complete overreach and intrusion into parental rights. We sued and we got it enjoined. And it was such a fringe idea. Yeah. And now it is just a mainstream plank of GOP primary campaign. I really can't overstate how horrifying it is that something that I think was really viewed as beyond the pale is now completely mainstreamed within, you know, that segment of the political system. And I like to say that we have a democracy problem in these states where the majority does not support these policies. They are not popular policies, but you have extremely gerrymandered legislatures that are immune to the normal pressures, not just from political opponents, but from political allies. The business community, so mainstream conservatives, are completely marginalized, and it's all MAGA, MAGA, MAGA. And I think that the normal restraints you have in the political system just don't seem to be applying in a lot of these places. And what's depressing is, like, as you noted, 6 trial courts have declared these bans to be likely unconstitutional and enjoined them, including 3 judges appointed by President Trump. But we had a pretty devastating ruling by the 6th Circuit Court of Appeals that stayed, sort of put on hold one of those injunctions, saying that they thought it was likely constitutional. And I think that we have an incredibly conservative judiciary right now, where people who were previously one of the most conservative judges on the bench are now in the middle or to the left. And I think that is a reality that we're all unfortunately contending with.
Right. I just think the Overton window has shifted so far in terms of what's appropriate, what is normal or mainstream, both in the judiciary and in these state legislatures where bills are being passed.
That's absolutely true. I couldn't agree more.
And speaking of a conservative judiciary body, do you expect that the Supreme Court will intervene at any point on the anti-trans legislation? And where do you think the justices would land on that question?
You know, hope springs eternal. The general rule of thumb these days, having the Supreme Court intervene is not something that I seek to do. Spend a lot of stuff telling the Supreme Court it doesn't have to intervene. And so when things get to the Supreme Court, we argue our heart out and sometimes we win. But I don't think that I don't think anyone is under the illusion right now that the Supreme Court is the best forum for making progress on our issues at the moment.
Kind of related to that, how do you feel like you're end goal as an attorney has shifted? You know, you've worked on Obergefell, you've worked on other really landmark cases that pushed forward LGBTQ rights using the judiciary as a place where progress could be made, especially when the legislature or Congress wasn't going to do that work. How has your kind of end goal changed?
Yeah, well, so I'll answer that in a couple of ways. One thing I do want to just highlight is when progress is made, I think that there is a reinforcing dynamic between the courts and popular legislatures. So when the court affirms the dignity of LGBTQ people, the legislatures also follow suit in passing laws legalizing marriage, and that makes the court reaffirm it even more. You saw that Brown versus Board was followed by, you know, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act. I think, unfortunately, the opposite is true also, that when the court says it's not going to protect certain people or certain types of rights, I think that is also just taken as a signal by legislatures that they're not worthy of protection or that sort of open season. And I sort of cannot overstate the effect that the Dobbs decision has had. That's the decision that overruled Roe and Casey and said that the Constitution no longer protects the right to have an abortion. It has really sent a message to legislatures that everything is on the table. Everything we've said, all the precedents are potentially up for grabs. Pass whatever laws you want. The worst that can happen is that they'll be struck down. And there used to be a little bit of a deterrent effect of legislatures thinking if we go too far, the Supreme Court will stop us. So we want to pass laws that will go as far as possible without prompting the Supreme Court to slap us down. And I think the opposite is true now. There's an invitation to pass whatever laws you can to tee up issues to get the Supreme Court to say new things that contradict what they said before. And so I do think that it's not like the two work very much in tandem. But like I said, what my long-term goal is I guess I have a medium-term goal, which is to limit the damage as much as possible, to have harm reduction, to protect as many people as we can for as long as we can, to give as many trans kids as possible a chance to flourish and grow up, be happy, healthy kids, happy, healthy teens, and happy, healthy adults until the political and judicial system has progressed from where it is. It's like a winter period, and there will be another spring with things growing again. And we sort of need to hold down the fort and make things as ready as possible for that to happen.
I mean, I think you make an excellent point that Dobbs really did invite people to avoid the dignity of other humans. I mean, I think Clarence Thomas explicitly issued an invitation to attack all precedents besides Loving versus Virginia, because he wants to stay married to Ginny, which I appreciate. She must feel really loved. And I'm really glad that you're working so hard to keep a space in the world where trans kids can grow up and be happy and healthy, because I know a lot of wonderful, wonderful trans kids who are slowly turning into teenagers, which is hard to believe. And I'm so happy with what a great life they're living here in Seattle. And I wish that could be everywhere for them. So I guess in terms of that, what are the next steps in challenging bills like DeSantis's Don't Say Gay legislation in Florida and responding to the Sixth Circuit's ruling in favor of bans on gender-affirming medical care?
Sure. So for things like Don't Say Gay, I am really lucky to be at an organization that has so many brilliant colleagues working in so many different areas of constitutional and civil rights protection. So we really work very closely with our colleagues in our free speech departments in challenging those laws, in challenging drag bans, which those cases bring me a lot of joy. Drag is joyful. And it's an area where the First Amendment, at least for the time being, is still being enforced in ways that protect our community. And so that's very good to see. And so we sue where we can. We have to be strategic that not every place has courts that will be likely be receptive to our arguments. But then also for a lot of these restrictions and school policies, things aren't going to change without organizing. There's just a well-organized movement of Moms for Liberty, whatever it's called. It's a very well-organized movement, and people need to get organized, and the courts are not going to save us from this stuff. What we can do with the courts at most is slow things down, but we need political change, and we need local communities organizing and showing up at these meetings and being as powerful voices as all the folks they bus in to protest, you know, books about gay penguins.
Yeah, I think once you realize that the judiciary will no longer be in your back corner to defend you, you really have to step up on every other aspect of advocacy and organizing.
And look, we're increasingly living in an incredibly, incredibly divided country, where not only are there differences in so-called red states and so-called blue states, but those differences also are reflected in the judges that are picked in those states and in the state Supreme Courts, obviously. But we are going to have a completely balkanized system where the way we are headed is there will be an almost virtual overlap in the states where abortion is legal and the states where gender-affirming care is legal if we keep heading in the same direction. And you have a lot of amazing judges being nominated to courts, but they're not nominated to courts that oversee jurisdictions where a lot of these laws are passed. So I think you're having protections for people that are already more protected, and people in places where they're not protected are being left even more vulnerable.
So switching tones a little bit, we want to talk about 303 Creative because it was such a recent ruling and could have so many implications for the work that you do and the kind of lawsuits. I think, at least from my perspective, similarly to Dobbs, I mean, less so, it's more narrow, but it could in that way lead to a lot of other lawsuits, people trying to push the law even further in the wrong direction. So tell us a little bit about 303 Creative and what the difference is between 303 Creative and Masterpiece Cake Shop and why the court chose to rule so much more broadly in this case.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the answer to your question, the short answer is Justice Kennedy and Justice Ginsburg. but I'll give a much longer answer to the question. So Masterpiece Cake Shop was a case where a couple went in, and one of the men's moms, they went in to buy a wedding cake, and they were looking at the catalog of what cakes are available until it was clear that it was for a same-sex marriage. And the owner of the cake shop said, sorry, I don't do those. And so that violated Colorado's civil rights statute. The case went to the Supreme Court, and the problem for the cake shop there is that there's, at least for the time being, a Supreme Court precedent called Smith that says that if a law is neutral and generally applicable, then there's no sort of exception to it the judges can create for violating it based on religious beliefs. And to be frank, the ACLU has historically had concerns with that principle. There's a lot of minority religions that have long been protected by religious exemptions, although our position has also always been that there is a compelling governmental interest in anti-discrimination and that religious beliefs don't give you a license to discriminate. But so because they couldn't really bring a viable free exercise challenge, they try to argue that not creating a cake is a form of speech. That making me make a cake is compelled speech because this is my artistic cake. And frankly, like, these First Amendment arguments are being used as a new Lochner to strike down all sorts of laws. That posting a sign saying that is prohibited by federal law compels me to speak. That me donating campaign finance is speech. Union dues are speech. The Supreme Court is using the First Amendment to really dismantle all sorts of laws. But in the context of anti-discrimination laws, Justice Kennedy wrote an opinion that said, you know, this is a really sensitive issue. And I think that the way that the Civil Rights Commission in Colorado handled it, they thought they were hostile and disrespectful to the religious beliefs because they said that all sorts of things have been justified based on religion and that doesn't make it okay. And therefore, since the proceedings were tainted by religious hostility, I'm going to, you know, say that the claims have to be dismissed, which is a very odd thing to do because the remedy, if the proceedings were tainted by religious hostility, would have been to remand for new proceedings, not tainted by hostility. You don't sort of dismiss a case usually based on that. Justice Kennedy also had all this language about we can't have like a general rule saying you can refuse to provide goods and services to LGBT people, even a general rule in the context of wedding-related services. So that was a fairly narrow opinion. Justice Gorsuch wrote a decision saying he thought they also had a free speech right to refuse service. And the irony of that decision at the time about, oh, you can't have language that's so disrespectful of religious beliefs, is that later that term, they struck down a crisis pregnancy center regulation on compelled speech grounds. And there's all sorts of language in that opinion accusing people wanting to regulate crisis pregnancy centers, comparing them to like Nazi eugenicists. And so this idea of not using inflammatory language really seems to only be going in one direction here. All sorts of horrible things, the court says, when they strike down laws, they view as being too woke in a way that violates the First Amendment. But the slightest hint of criticism of underlying religious beliefs or the pointing out that religious beliefs were used to justify race discrimination are things that are really off the table right now. But anyway, so that was Masterpiece Cake Shop. And then Justice Kennedy retired and Justice Ginsburg died and they took another case in 303 Creative. And so 303 Creative is a wave of similar cases where these fake businesses were set up for the purposes of litigation, saying, I have not yet gotten into the wedding business, but I want to either like create films about weddings. I want to be a videographer, but my videography isn't going to be like what people want me to video, videotape, whatever the word is. This is my own independent creative vision where I'm making a mini documentary of a wedding. Or this is my website. I've never yet created a wedding website, but I want to create one and I'm going to have a business doing it. And it's going to be my own creative thing instead of a plug in the names of the people getting married. And so no record of these businesses actually existing, much less having customers. And in fact, in the Eighth Circuit case about the videography business, that business actually never opened after they won their case. Because who wants to buy a videography service where they're giving their own vision of the wedding? Like, that's not what you buy when you're having a wedding photographer. So anyway, so based on this business with no existing record, the Supreme Court said that making a website is pure speech. And because it's pure speech, it violates the First Amendment to require someone to make it as part of a public accommodations law. And there are all sorts of things that could be done to cabin the decision. On its face, they say this is pure speech. It is a product that expresses the owner's expressive message, and it is an original customized product. So they view it not as a template where you type in these things and a computer image is generated for you, that it's some original creative vision each time. Now, those facts are not actual facts. They're just stipulations that Colorado entered into. So all these things being said about this business really don't often correspond to how businesses operate in the real world, but no one had to bother with that because Colorado stipulated to these things. And so there's a lot of uncertainty about how that will apply in other cases. There's, if we stick to what 303 Creative actually decided, maybe a lot of other businesses won't qualify for that. Of course, we know that people bringing these cases have also argued that the cakes and flowers also are expressive. And we know that Justice Gorsuch agreed with that in his concurrence. And we know that there's a lot of folks that are going to be trying to push that envelope. Everything, every service involves speech. You can't like take someone's order at a restaurant without speaking. And so the way the real world works is nothing is really pure speech. It's speech mixed with some element of conduct. And how they're going to translate these artificial stipulations into evaluating real world businesses is a big question. And we'll have to see what happens.
I want to talk about standing really quickly, because this was something that generated a lot of buzz right before the decision came out. So is this a First Amendment pre-enforcement challenge where harm doesn't actually need to be experienced as long as it's imminent?
So the rules for standing for the First Amendment are more relaxed than for other types of challenges. That's sort of also because of the chill that speech restrictions have. So it's a lot easier to bring pre-enforcement challenges for First Amendment violations than for other things. And of course, the ACLU has had many of its cases, pre-enforcement challenges, dismissed for lack of standing, including our challenge to the warrantless mass spying surveillance that we know is happening, but we're told we don't have standing for, but a variety of other things too. For decades, why did it take so long to have Lawrence versus Texas? Because we needed a fact pattern where people were actually prosecuted under these laws. Gay people could not say, I fear prosecution, because they were told they don't have standing because they hadn't established a credible threat of enforcement. But there's different sets of rules being applied in these sets of cases. And some of that is the difference in the nature of the claims. But I also think there's other less doctrinal differences happening too. So you have standing to bring pre-enforcement challenges. We bring pre-enforcement challenges all the time. That's not really the issue here. I think the bigger issue is a ripeness issue of we don't know what service you're providing yet. We don't know like what customers are actually going to be coming. We don't know the nature of the refusal you're going to be making. And that is a problem for deciding cases. Normally, you defend your rights and you would turn someone away. And then when a complaint is made against you, you would defend against it. But because this is under the rubric of speech, the court is much more willing to entertain it without any factual record. So I can't give like a one size fits all view on standing and pre-enforcement. I don't want to say that it is uniformly bad to have pre-enforcement challenges. They can be very good. But I do think that in practice, there's a big difference in what cases are allowed to get heard on a pre-enforcement basis and which ones are not.
Similarly, do you think there's just a more general problem with the court even completely ignoring the factual record? Like, I'm thinking of Bremerton. I think we saw a similar thing in 303 Creative, right? Like, there was even that fake scenario of a couple requesting a cake, but then it was actually a straight man. It just seems like the court is kind of throwing aside any facts that might make it harder for them to make an ideological ruling in some senses.
I don't know. I think that Bremerton, they obviously, I think, said things that were flatly inconsistent with the factual record. On the other hand, if the court makes holdings based on facts that didn't happen, that those precedents also are tied to those fake facts. So in some ways, it sort of narrows the scope of the precedent because the next real world situation is not going to match the stylized facts that the decision has. So like on its face, does Bremerton allow incredible disruption that actually happened there? Not necessarily, because they pretend that disruption didn't exist. So in future cases, you can say this is different. The court said this and these facts are different than that. So I don't know. I also think the way that the court frequently characterizes anti-discrimination policies and laws or finds religious hostility doesn't reflect an accurate version of facts either. But I can't make a grand sweeping statement of that. I'm sure lots of folks have their own feelings about cases in which they think that the factual record was ignored. Folks with issues different from mine.
I mean, I thought that article in general discussing the gay couple, who they turned out one of the men listed in the suit was straight and married to a woman. I thought that was incredible investigative reporting from ProPublica. I was personally shocked that it had made it that far as part of the record of the case and no one had like called him up and been like, hey, did you do this? That was astounding to me that it was just absolute lies, even if it didn't really matter. In the substance of a Supreme Court brief, I found that really shocking. So what were you most surprised by in the court's 303 creative ruling?
Surprised by? It was narrower than I was ready for it to be. After the arguments, I expected a ruling that would have been 4-3-3 creative. And my concern was, well, how broad is it going to be? And so it was actually a little bit narrower in focusing not just on the fact that this involves writing and website design, but also focusing on these stipulations about it reflecting the creator's message, which I think were stipulations that Colorado should not have entered into, and on this being an original customized service. So I read that as saying, if we have a preset catalog for you to pick from and you just pick this design that we already made, I don't read that as being covered by 303 Creative. I read 303 Creative as saying it has to be something that is really just originally created for you, not just we sort of plug in your names. So I think those are all things that could really narrow the scope. But what a precedent means isn't really decided until many years after the precedent comes out. We don't know what it means until you see what courts do with it. So that's what I was surprised about.
Yeah, I think you're right in that a lot of people have said, and I think it's somewhat true, that 303 Creative is a rather narrow ruling, but also we won't know exactly what the precise implications of the case are until it's applied by lower courts. And relatedly, a judge has already used the decision to claim that she can refuse to marry same-sex couples, and then salon owners are refusing to serve members of the LGBTQ+ community. That's examples I've seen. Where do you see those cases going, and do you think there are potential unforeseen implications of 303 Creative?
Yeah, I think it could be, like, so many things can be characterized as speech. So I think you're going to need lower courts or the Supreme Court to sort of put limits on that. It's potentially limitless or potentially narrow. And I think there's going to be a lot of fights in courts about that. And I think you're going to have some lower court judges that are going to be very eager to read it extremely broadly. And so I think we'll have to see how that gets sorted out. But I do think it's sort of too soon to tell. Because again, I mean, it's based on fake facts. It's based on stipulations, not real world events. So who knows what happens when it actually has to make contact with reality. You know, things that are in the wings is there's several like videographer cases that have been put on hold. The Fourth Circuit and the Sixth Circuit, I believe, have cases, and those are going to be the most immediate things. And then we'll see what happens for other stuff too. So does this include pictures, you know, the Justice Jackson's question, you know, taking Santa pictures at a mall or not? The majority just said, we don't have to deal with that because of these stipulations we have, but they're going to have to deal with it eventually. And so we just have to wait and see.
Something I noticed, maybe particularly as a Jewish girl reading this case, is that there's elevation of religious liberty for mainstream Christian beliefs. So I'm curious, I guess, how you've seen the quote elevating religious interests and religious liberty for mostly Christian beliefs in recent years, kind of at the expense of the Establishment Clause and other constitutional principles.
That's a great question. When religious minorities have historically made arguments about burdens on religion, they did not receive nearly the same solicitousness that the court gives majority religions. There's no contest. The classic Establishment Clause, Free Exercise Clause cases are laws banning businesses from being open on Sundays because we have one day of rest. And when Jewish business owners challenged it, those claims were rejected because there's such an important interest in having a uniform day of rest. There's just decades of claims of religious freedom being deemed sort of like too inconvenient. And now that it's religious majorities making those claims, they are just receiving incredible deference from the court. And it's really sort of incredible to see. Look, this is a court that upheld Trump's Muslim ban. Right. And this is even when Kennedy was on it. It was the court that said that at city council meetings, they could make people come and stand up and listen to a Christian prayer. And in fact, there's a judge in Texas that did it in his courtroom. And the Fifth Circuit upheld that, saying technically someone could have left, even though the evidence showed that they couldn't, that if people left, they were punished. So I do think that historically, freedom of religion has been ostensibly, it gave protections to religious minorities, but those protections were fairly modest in the grand scheme of things. And it is sort of a funhouse mirror of that in the way that they're being invoked on a supercharged basis to justify things that were never previously justified. And there's a big set of people that think just all the Establishment Clause precedents were wrong and want to overturn them and completely reset the balance. And that is just a long-term goal. And so this is completely consistent with that.
Yeah, I was going to bring up the ruling on the travel ban because that's the same term as Masterpiece Cake Shop and just the hypocrisy of them saying we're so concerned about religious animus in Masterpiece Cake Shop, but then just ignoring Trump's comments in the clearly anti-Muslim rhetoric that went into the travel ban. Relatedly, where do you think the court goes next? What cases do you see potentially on the horizon that could further push the needle towards conservative interests?
I think there's a whole huge array of interests at play here. I think that on the issue of religious liberty and LGBTQ stuff, I think there's going to be more cases about private schools that discriminate wanting to receive federal funds or state funds without the restrictions on discrimination that go along with that. Oklahoma is trying to create a religious charter school, so like a public school that's religious. I think that will be going places. I'm sure that there's going to be cases expanding the rights of religious organizations to discriminate in their hiring. Eventually, the court's going to have to decide whether the Bostock decision saying that LGBTQ discrimination is sex discrimination under Title VII, they'll eventually have to decide how that applies to other statutes as well. And I also think, you know, obviously, these horrible gender-affirming care laws will be a circuit split at some point, and the court will then have to take it at some point. So whether that's this term or next term or the term after, I'm sure that will be coming. What else? I mean, there's a lot, and I think we want them to wait as long as possible to take them, which is what should do. They're supposed to wait for an issue to be fully ventilated in the lower courts and wait for a circuit split to happen. But things aren't moving in a positive direction. And I think the victories that we have are victories where the court was pushed to go even more conservative. And the court said, no, we're going to keep the law the way it is. But that's very different from things where the court moves the law in a positive direction, at least as far as the issues I work on are concerned. Obviously, there'll be continued attacks on abortion and birth control, which are very scary.
I guess because this is a show primarily, hopefully, for high schoolers, we want to bring it back to the young people who are listening. And we want to ask, what would you say to the young members of the LGBTQ plus community who kind of see the ruling in 303 Creative and maybe see their rights being stripped away? And maybe more importantly, how students who can understand the slope from 303 Creative to Bostock and Obergefell, what would you say to them?
I would say, get angry. This isn't okay. It's really, really bad. And the court's makeup exists because of one presidential election. So I think that rights are going to have to be fought out at the state and local level constantly. And we got to push for like the judiciary to change. So, I mean, I think that don't accept this as the way that things have to be or the way that the law inevitably is. And stay outraged about it. And this sort of goes back to what I said before, like the courts can do a lot of things, but they're not going to save us just for the foreseeable future. It's not going to be a font of rights. And we really need to come through this and make stuff better. But be angry. It's a real terrifying time. What I would say to a queer kid in high school in half of the country, it's really hard and scary, and own that. And you're gonna make it, but the courts aren't gonna be the reason why.
Amid such a terrifying time, how do you personally try to maintain hope and keep doing the work you're doing, even if it often seems like it is fruitless?
I cry a lot. That's a big thing I do, especially talking with plaintiffs and recruiting, talking with clients and parents. That's really, really hard. But like I said, we need people to limit the harm and to slow stuff down. And that is a really important job. That just happens to be my job right now. And hopefully before I retire, it'll change a bit. But we get our victories when we have them and we sort of savor them. But every bit that we're able to slow things down is a victory in its way. We'll see how much that lasts until there's too much burnout. But for now, it still keeps me going.
Well, we're so lucky to have you fighting this fight and just so lucky that you were able to come speak with us. It's been truly great. It's awesome.
Thanks for having me. These are obviously issues I care deeply about, and I think it's very good that more and more people are given sort of the tools to sort of look at these issues themselves. It certainly didn't exist when I was in high school. There was no SCOTUS blog or anything like that even. So thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you so much to Josh for joining us on the podcast. His insight is invaluable, and his experience doing this work day in and day out is something that you can't replicate with any other guest. So you're so lucky that he was able to come on the podcast and that you were able to hear from him about how he is fighting the fight every single day and how we all should be angry and should be doing something about it just like he is. He's such an inspiration, along with being an expert and being incredibly smart.
We're going to continue doing our term recapping. We're going to talk a lot more about the affirmative action case. We're going to continue to talk about other cases that the court has decided this term. And while you wait for us to come to you with more information, you can leave us a rating, drop us a review. And for more coverage of the Supreme Court by teenagers, you can check out the High School SCOTUS website at highschoolscotus.com. On the blog, you can read oral argument previews, opinion analysis, and interviews with eminent legal scholars. Everything you need to stay in touch with the court. That's highschoolscotus.com. And we can't wait to see you next time.